Naturally, I have sometimes wondered to myself how things might have turned out in the long run had I relented on those several occasions when Miss Kenton suggested we reinstate our evening meetings. Indeed, it might even be said that this small decision of mine constituted something of a key turning point, and perhaps, occurring as it did around the same time as these events, my encounter with Miss Kenton in the dining room the afternoon she received the news of her aunt's death might be seen as yet another turning point of sorts. News of the death had arrived some hours earlier. Indeed, I had myself knocked on the door of her parlour that morning to hand her the letter. She became very still, but to her credit, she remained composed, reading the letter through at least twice. "It is from Mrs. Johnson, a companion of my aunt. She says my aunt died the day before yesterday. The funeral is to take place tomorrow. I wonder if it might be possible for me to take the day off. I'm sure that could be arranged, Miss Kenton. Thank you, Mr. Stevens. Forgive me, but perhaps I may now have a few moments alone." I made my exit and paused out in the corridor. It was not impossible that Miss Kenton, at that very moment, and only a few feet from me, was actually crying. The thought provoked a strange feeling to rise within me, causing me to stand there hovering in the corridor for some moments. But eventually I judged it best to await another opportunity to express my sympathy, and went on my way. As it turned out, I did not see her again until the afternoon, when I came across her in the dining room. By this point I had been preoccupied for some hours with the matter of Miss Kenton's sorrow, and when I heard her footsteps entering the dining room, I had waited a minute or so, then put down what I was doing, and followed her in. "Ah, Miss Kenton," I said, "and how might you be this afternoon?" "Quite well, thank you, Mr. Stevens. I have been meaning to ask you if you were experiencing any particular problems with the new recruits." "Thank you, Mr. Stevens, but the new girls are very satisfactory to me." I watched her filling the sideboard and waited to see if she would say anything further. When it became clear she would not, I said, "As a matter of fact, Miss Kenton, I have noticed one or two things have fallen in standard just recently. I do feel you might be a little less complacent as regards new arrivals." For a second, Miss Kenton looked confused. Then she turned towards me, and a certain strain was visible on her face. "I beg your pardon, Mr. Stevens." "For instance, Miss Kenton, although the crockery is being washed to as high a standard as ever, I have noticed it is being replaced on the kitchen shelves in a manner which, while not obviously dangerous, would nevertheless, over time, result in more breakages than necessary."
"Is that so, Mr. Stevens?"
"It is not like you to have overlooked such obvious things, Miss Kenton." Miss Kenton looked away from me, and again an expression crossed her face as though she were trying to puzzle out something that had quite confused her. She did not look upset so much as very weary. Then she closed the sideboard, said, "Please excuse me, Mr. Stevens," and left the room. Naturally, when one looks back to such instances today, they may indeed take the appearance of being crucial, precious moments in one's life. But, of course, at the time, it was as though one had available a never-ending number of days, months, years in which to sort out the vagaries of one's relationship with Miss Kenton. There was surely nothing to indicate at the time that such evidently small incidents would render whole dreams forever irredeemable. But I see I'm becoming unduly introspective. No doubt this has to do with the trying nature of the events I have had to endure this evening. My kind hosts, Mr. and Mrs. Taylor, would never, I'm certain, have knowingly put me through what I have just endured. But the fact is, once a number of their neighbours had come calling, a most discomforting set of events began to unfold around me. Just as we had finished supper, we heard footsteps approaching on the gravel outside, and Mr. Taylor said, "Hello, now, could this be?" He had said this more or less to himself, but then we heard, as though in reply, a voice call outside, "It's George Andrews, just happened to be walking by." He placed himself on a small stool by the entrance and removed his Wellington boots with some effort.
"The name's Andrews, sir," he said. "Very good evening to you. I'm very sorry to hear about your mishap. We're all very pleased you could stop by."
The way he said this seemed to suggest the whole village was aware of my mishap.
In fact, I was soon to discover this was very close to being the case. The next few minutes saw the arrival of another visitor, a man with an appearance much like that of Mr. Andrews. The newcomer introduced himself to me as Morgan, Sir Trevor Morgan. Soon a middle-aged couple were shown in, who were introduced to me as Mr. and Mrs. Harry Smith. Mr. Harry Smith was a small man with a rather intense expression that furrowed his brow. Someone said, "Your health, sir." I was being toasted by the whole company. I smiled and said, "I assure you the privilege is all mine." "You're very kind, sir," Mrs. Smith said. "That's the way a real gentleman is." There was agreement all round. Then Mrs. Smith said, "We told Dr. Carlyle you were here, sir. The doctor would be very pleased to make your acquaintance." There was a murmur of agreement. Then Mr. Taylor broke the silence by saying, "You can tell a true gentleman from a false one that's just dressed in finery. Now take yourself. There's something else that marks you out as a gentleman. Hard to put your finger on it, but it's plain for all to see that's got eyes." "Dr. Carlyle's got it too," Mr. Taylor said. Mr. Morgan, who had said little since his arrival, bent forward and said to me, "What do you suppose it is, sir? Maybe one that's got it can better say what it is." I gave a small cough and said, "Well, it's hardly for me to pronounce upon qualities I may or may not possess. However, one would suspect that the quality being referred to might be most usefully termed dignity." "Mind you," put in Mr. Harry Smith, "with all respect for what you say, sir, dignity is something every man and woman in this country can strive for and get. That's what we fought Hitler for, after all. And it's one of the privileges of being born English that you're born free, and you're born so that you can express your opinion freely." "No, no, Harry," Mr. Taylor said. "I can see you're warming up to one of your political speeches." "Have you had much to do with politics yourself, sir?" Mr. Andrews asked. "Not directly as such," I said. "More so before the war, perhaps. In fact, I tended to concern myself with international affairs more than domestic ones. Foreign policy, that is to say." "Excuse me, sir," Mrs. Taylor said eventually, "but have you ever met Mr. Churchill?"
"He did come to the house on a number of occasions, but the likes of Mr. Eden and Lord Halifax were more frequent visitors in those days."
Mr. Andrews said, "What sort of a man is Mr. Eden? I always had the impression he's a jolly decent sort."
"I would say that is by and large an accurate picture, but he may have been much changed by pressures. Public life can change people unrecognisably in a few short years."
"Oh, I don't doubt that, sir," said Mr. Andrews. "Even Harry here got himself involved with his politics a few years back, and he's never been the same man since."
Mr. Harry Smith shrugged and allowed a smile to cross his face. Then he said,
"The way I see it, England's a democracy, and we in this village have suffered as much as anyone fighting to keep it that way. Now it's up to us to exercise our rights. We owe it to the lads we lost from this village."
I said, "I think I understand your position very well, Mr. Smith. I dare say it was a very similar urge which led me to become involved in great affairs before the war. Then, as now, world peace seemed something we had only the most fragile grasp of, and I wished to do my part."
"Excuse me, sir," said Mr. Harry Smith, "but my point was a slightly different one. This is a democratic country we're living in. We fought for it. We've all got to play our part."
"I wonder what could have happened to Dr. Carlyle," Mrs. Smith said. "I'm sure the gentleman could just about use some educated talk now."
"I really ought to be retiring," I said. I feel quite exhausted."
"But I'm sure this is the doctor now, sir," said Mrs. Smith. "Do wait a few more minutes."
Just as she said this, there came a knock, and a voice said,
"It's just me, Mrs. Taylor."
The doctor came up to the table and held out his hand to me.
"Richard Carlyle," he said with a cheerful smile as I rose to shake it. "Rotten bit of luck about your car. Still, trust you're being well looked after here."
"Thank you," I replied. "Everyone has been most kind."
"A gentleman was just telling us, doctor," Mrs. Smith said, "he knows Mr. Churchill."
"Is that so?"
"And not only Mr. Churchill, he knows Mr. Eden and Lord Halifax."
"Really?" I could sense the doctor's eyes examining me closely. Then he regained his cheerful manner and asked, "Touring around for pleasure?"
"Principally," I said.
Seizing what seemed a suitable moment, I rose to my feet, saying, "Please excuse me, but I really must now retire." I had almost left the room when the doctor's voice caused me to halt at the door. "I say, old chap," he said, "I have a visit to make in Stanbury first thing in the morning. I'd be happy to give you a lift up to your car. 7:30, all right for you?"
"That would be most helpful indeed."
I trust I need hardly underline the extent of the discomfort I suffered tonight on account of the unfortunate misunderstanding concerning my person. However, there are other aspects to this evening's events which warrant a few moments' thought. There is the matter of Mr. Harry Smith's pronouncements on the nature of dignity. How can ordinary people be expected to have strong opinions on all manner of things? As it happens, there is an instance that comes to mind which illustrates the real limits of whatever truth may be contained in Mr. Harry Smith's views, an episode that took place before the war. I was rung for late one night to the drawing-room, where his lordship had been entertaining three gentlemen since dinner. When I entered, all the gentlemen stopped talking and looked at me. Then his lordship said, "Stevens, Mr. Spencer here wishes a word with you." The gentleman in question said, "We need your help on a certain matter we've been debating. Do you suppose the debt situation regarding America is a significant factor in the present low levels of trade?" I quickly saw the situation for what it was. It was clearly expected that I'd be baffled by the question. "I'm very sorry, sir," I said, "but I am unable to be of assistance on this matter."
"Then perhaps you will help us on another matter. Would you say that the currency problem in Europe would be made better or worse if there were to be an arms agreement between the French and the Bolsheviks?"
"I'm very sorry, sir, but I am unable to be of assistance on this matter." There was suppressed laughter. "You see, gentlemen," Mr. Spencer said, turning to the others, "we still persist with the notion that this nation's decisions be left in the hands of our good man here and others like him. Why, you may as well ask a committee of the Mothers' Union to organize a war campaign." I had all but forgotten the episode by the following morning, when Lord Darlington came into the billiard room and said, "Look here, Stevens, it was dreadful, the ordeal we put you through last night. But you see, Mr. Spencer had a point to prove. Democracy is something for a bygone era. We are, quite frankly, behind the times in this country. I mean, look at Germany and Italy. See what strong leadership can do if it's allowed to act." It occurs to me that many of Lord Darlington's ideas will seem today rather odd. But the fact is, such great affairs will always be beyond the understanding of those such as you and I. And those of us who wish to make our mark must realize that we best do so by devoting our attention to those great gentlemen in whose hands the destiny of civilization truly lies. What is there at all culpable in such an attitude? How can one possibly be held to blame in any sense because the passage of time has shown that Lord Darlington's efforts were misguided, even foolish? It is hardly my fault if his lordship's life and work have turned out today to look at best a sad waste. And it is quite illogical that I should feel any regret or shame on my own account.